Oh, we do. Okay. We have a sound system, so we are going to get started. This panel is on gender as a linchpin of development, how to frame a new goal. And it's going to be a somewhat wide-ranging discussion, but there are really two main questions that I'm hoping will come out of this talk, that I'm hoping the solutions will come out of this talk. One is, do we need a standalone gender goal? And the second is, what should be in it? My name is Michelle Goldberg. I'm a senior writer at The Nation who writes frequently on both gender issues and international development issues. And our panel, we have Ambassador Greta Gunnarsdóttir, who is the permanent representative of Iceland to the United Nations. We have Ambassador George Wilfred Talbot, the permanent representative of the Republic of Guyana to the United Nations. The Honorable Gabriela Montaño, President of the Senate of Bolivia, and Mr. John Hendra, Assistant Secretary General, Deputy Executive Director for Policy and Program, UN Women. So my first question is for you. You're not. Oh, we have.
El traductor. Sí, can I translate?
So my first question, as soon as we get the simultaneous translation working.
Otherwise, we can call the conference officer again, as we did this morning.
Okay, technical difficulties are solved? Okay, so now we're really going to get started. And I'm going to start with a question for John Hendra, which is, you know, UN Women has been leading the charge and calling for a standalone goal with three different components. And my question is, why a standalone goal as opposed to integrating questions of gender equality into all of the goals? Does having a standalone goal threaten to kind of silo these issues from the broader development agenda?
Great. Thank you very much for your question, and thank you very much to IPU for the opportunity to be here this afternoon. I'd like to say very clearly and strongly that we believe that we do need a standalone goal on gender equality, women's rights, and women's empowerment. And I would say we need a standalone goal for four reasons. First, that we have a lot of unfinished business in terms of the MDGs, and I would say particularly around Goal 5 on improving maternal health, where still 800 women die every day from complications from childbirth. So the first reason we need a standalone goal is really to finish the unfinished business. The second reason is to really address the structural discriminatory constraints against gender equality and women's empowerment and women's rights. And you really need a focus, and you really need to be able to address gender inequality directly. Thirdly is really in terms of investment in gender equality, as we all know, is one of the best investments you can make, I would say, particularly investment in girls' education. So gender equality and women's empowerment has a synergistic impact, has an impact across the whole agenda. And then fourthly, The fourth reason is that we really need a goal to focus the minds, to focus policy action, to focus you as parliamentarians, to focus societies around really addressing the underlying constraints. So I think for those four reasons, I would argue that we very much need a standalone goal.
Microphone working? She needs to turn it on.
Is there something? Now it's working?
Yeah.
Okay, so let me ask once again to the Honorable Gabriela Montaño. I understand that you have different ideas about what the goal should consist of than you and women. Can you talk about that?
Bueno, sí creo que...
Yes, I... First of all, good afternoon, everybody. The subject of development. With regard to development, Bolivia has established a different model from growth as a center of the model for development. And that model for development involves the building of a new model for the state where diversity in our country, for the first time in our history, and the existence of 36 indigenous peoples and the establishment of men and women is important for a state. And this state, and this is the wealth of the plurinational state of Bolivia. And we are developing a new political constitution for the state where the building and the complementarity of men and women and the diversity is central. That is how we define our state as a plurinational state, and we define our medal as a model of of well-being, very similar to what Ecuador said this morning. The logic is this well-being and living well implies many dimensions, and it's focused on the relationships of balance between people and a society in harmony with Mother Earth and nature. Throughout this model, gender equality means there is a fundamental structure, and it's cross-cutting for all aspects of development, for all forms of well-being. So if we're talking about making this subject cross-cutting, I think gender equality should be cross-cutting in all aspects of life. Bolivia has experienced very significant growth in the participation of women in the public and political spheres. Currently in the Senate, there are more than 50% of women senators, and this was done very quickly, just it being understood that gender equality is cross-cutting for all aspects of life. For instance, in the economic arena, in Bolivia, the distribution of land was inequitable between men and women. Women did not have access to the land title in the name of women. And this has changed substantially, and it has been a benefit for thousands of women in the countryside in Bolivia. And now they own their land, and it's not only the males which are owners. Access to credit is something which has also changed women's lives in Bolivia. Access to primary, secondary, and university education also. So in Bolivia, the approach was one of a cross-cutting method in all respects, and therefore it applies to all laws. It's not a single norm or a single definition or a single goal which all of these aspects of life can be contained.
Do you think that that model should also apply as we, as the world crafts the Sustainable Development Goals? I mean, should these gender issues also be cross-cutting across all the goals, or do we have them as a standalone goal?
I think they should be cross-cutting, and there is something which was not taken into account in the SDGs, and that's the subject of violence against women. Violence is an aspect which is caused and provoked for many regions, the many origins for it, but it is a subject which should be attacked from many angles. Violence against women generates the fact that women have less access to education, to health, to work, and to better living conditions. I think that the subject of violence should become more visible in the SDGs because it is one of the elements which puts women down in their development. So I believe in that it should be cross-cutting, but my concern is that it would be wrong to have just one goal, and that this subject could be just put in a corner of the interest, both in the States as well as in the United Nations, and even for our people. I don't think that we can have a goal which would only be of interest to women and which is only a women's problem, because all the problems which have to do with women are problems which have to do with society as a whole. And also, of course, it involves men, it involves the state, and with the United Nations.
Okay, so that is actually a good segue for my question to Ambassador Talbot, which is, what is the role of men, and how do you get men to buy into these goals? When you look at the MDGs, some of the MDGs that were the most successful were ones that were pretty uncontroversial. There's wide consensus that we want to reduce poverty. There's wide consensus that we want to educate girls. Whether there's wide consensus that we want real gender equality is, I think, a different question. How do you convince men that this isn't their loss, but the world's gain?
Thank you. Good afternoon to everyone. I come to that question as a man who has three women bosses. Immediate women bosses. The Director General of my foreign ministry is a woman. The Minister of Foreign Affairs of Guyana is a woman. And the third boss, and the most important, is my wife. Now, I believe that men have to be at the table in discussing issues relating to gender. Of course, the women, it is established, are the disadvantaged segment of the population in that regard, but gender, of course, is an issue involving both men and women. And the challenge, for example, and for that reason, I believe there is need for the issue to be addressed across the board. It is inevitable that issues of women will touch on all aspects of a sustainable development agenda. Women are 50% of the population of the world, the face of poverty is more likely to be that of a woman or a girl than it is likely to be male. And so if the Sustainable Development Agenda is to be about people, which it should be, I think women's issues and gender issues have to be cross-cutting. That is not to say that there may not be need for a standalone goal, and I think the points made by John, particularly as it relates to the unfinished agenda, which you speak to in your question, is very important that we finish that agenda. The question of maternal mortality, for example, is a very troubling question. To what extent men play a role in that, I don't know the answer to that question. To what extent the role of men impacts on the shortcomings in relation to maternal mortality, maternal health, I think the UN Women may have statistics on that, but certainly questions of gender, the question of gender-based violence, which is a major challenge for women in the Caribbean, in my own country, despite legislative provisions, and despite the fact that education, women are generally increasingly more educated than men in our region. They are occupying larger percentages of education at the secondary and the tertiary levels, and they're the majority of our graduates. But yet, women still continue to occupy places that are below their male counterparts in certain positions of authority in the society, in decision-making, etc. So to answer your question, I believe that there is need for the role of men is to be sensitized, is to grow in understanding of the particular concerns of women and the particular needs of the women populace, so that we are able to craft the kinds of solutions that take those needs into account.
And but do you think there's widespread consensus on gender equality, or do you think that consensus has to be encouraged or created? Or
I think there is a broad political consensus on gender equality. I think the agreements of the United Nations, the subscription to the relevant conventions, CEDAW, etc., I think evidence at a political level. There is certainly work to be done on dealing with some of the cultural issues and some of the stereotypes generated in our various societies, some of which may have historical and other kinds of roots. So I think the consensus exists at the political level, but there is an outworking in terms of translating that consensus in terms of policy, and some progress has been made at the policy level, at the legislative level, but then the cultural and other factors and other issues, poverty, you know, that can aggravate the challenges that are faced domestically, those have to be tackled. So there is need for a sort of a holistic approach to the question. Thank you.
This is a question for Ambassador Gunnarsdottir. You know, one of the reasons that people have talked about the need for a standalone gender goal is, of course, because most of the world's poor are women. But it also raises the question of whether the needs of women across the world in kind of such different cultural contexts can really be generalized. How do you come up with language or goals or targets that is as applicable to women in Iceland, which has, you know, some of the, which is, you know, kind of a light unto the nations in terms of gender equality, and that is also applicable in countries, you know, that have a lot more inequality?
Yes, thank you very much for this question. I think, I mean, we discussed this issue at my mission before I decided to participate in this meeting, and we agreed that when it comes to gender, the universal application of the goal will be much less challenging than when it comes to other goals. I mean, because after all, in all countries we have women, we might have different stages of gender equality and so on, but there are issues that are applicable more or less across the board, just varies in degree. So if I mention, for example, to eliminate all forms of violence against women and girls, that is applicable to all societies. And the same goes for women's participation in political decision-making. That is more or less applicable in all societies. And we could also go for access to economic activities like property rights, inheritance rights, etc. And then finally with also sexual and reproductive rights and reproductive health. So I think those as a standalone goal could be applicable to all countries. As we have seen it from our perspective, we would like to see a standalone goal and mainstreaming, gender mainstreaming, because there are issues like these issues that I mentioned that could be in a standalone goal applicable to all. And then if we do not consciously apply gender mainstreaming, we will not have sustainable development, because sustainable development cannot take place without women. It goes without saying. And what I have picked up in the discussion so far is what we haven't mentioned yet is human rights, because it says in your paper for this meeting that gender equality is good for society as a whole. And we hear this argument very much today. I mean, you have to take the women on board, because otherwise you will not have proper economic growth and so on. But it's not about that. It is about human rights in the end, because we are equal. That is really what it is about. Women and men are equal. We might not be so in practice in different societies, but that is a fact. And we have... I mean, all these documents, like the ambassador mentioned, I mean, we have the UN Charter, we have the CETO Convention, we have the commitments from Beijing, and these are commitments that have been made by all of us as the international community within the UN. So I think we have agreed on the basis, but it is just how to go about it. And really, the question, is there a need for a standalone goal? I think it is needed basically in order to ensure the political commitment. Because if we only go for gender mainstreaming, which we have committed ourselves to do anyway, I mean, not only when it comes to the goals, but it's something we should be doing according to the commitments we have made. If we do not have a standalone goal, we do not have this political focus on the gender issues. And that is why I really think it is important to have a standalone goal. And there is another issue that we need to also remember. When we are discussing gender, it's not only about women. It's about men and women. It's to rectify the situation. I mean, sometimes we have, you know, men, we need to look at also sometimes how are they faring in society. And like in my country, we have now the vast majority of students in university are women and not men. And I know that is applicable.
That's true almost everywhere, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is the trend. And why is that? And do we need to address it? I mean, this is one issue. And then, like, if we look at violence against women, we are not going to eliminate violence against women unless we address it together between men and women, because men have a lot, I mean, the role of men when it comes to violence against women. So we need to look at not only always the women, but men and women and how we can work together within societies.
So going back to Mr. Hendra, you mentioned that one reason that we need a goal is to mobilize political will. And part of mobilizing political will is mobilizing resources. I mean, one of the things that the MDGs did brilliantly was mobilize resources across the world. But we're in a very different situation today in the wake of the financial crisis and kind of global austerity. is it going? What are the challenges of mobilizing political will and mobilizing resources for a gender goal?
Well, I think the challenge is actually great, but before kind of answering that directly, maybe just to make a couple of other points based on the discussion so far, is we feel very much, and I feel very much, that we need a standalone goal for the reasons that I mentioned. I think particularly that we need to establish minimum standards and push change forward in three really critical areas. Any violence against women, and I fully agree with the President of the Senate, in terms of one of the problems with the MDGs is that any violence against women is not a part of the framework, and largely because the reason given was that we weren't able to properly measure it and benchmark it. So that's a challenge I'd like to come back to later. But secondly, also in terms of ensuring women's capabilities and access to and control over resources, and we talked about health and education and land and credit, decent work, sexual and reproductive health and rights, but also ensuring that women take part in all public and private decision-making, including the household and the issue of unpaid care. So we feel those are three really critical areas, but then gender clearly has to be addressed across, has to be mainstreamed and addressed across the framework. But I think our challenge that we have is choosing targets that will really mean a fundamental change in women's lives. I mean, really be able to prioritize and choose the right targets. So, I believe that very much it's a twin-track approach that was advocated in Beijing, where when you have an issue of inequality, you need to address it directly, frontally, but you also need to make sure that gender equality, which is both women and men, is properly addressed across the framework. In terms of resources and political will, I think it's unfortunately a really, really critical issue for several reasons. One, we've seen already, particularly with austerity and austerity policies, and I would say particularly in Europe, we will see quite a significant negative impact on women. In many countries under austerity, women have been disproportionately affected because the public sector is cut first and women's employment is largely in the public sector. Also, women around the world are often in more vulnerable employment and often lack proper social protection, and those are sadly things that are also cut in terms of austerity. So there's a big negative economic impact. We've seen even in how international assistance is allocated from 2011 to 2012 to 2013, over 1 year, the amount of ODA that went towards women's issues and gender equality went down by 20%. That's a huge drop. So women's rights and gender equality is chronically underfunded. I think it is really important to have the standalone focused on funding, but we have a long way to go to turn that situation around. Despite, I think, a lot of evidence that shows that investment in empowerment of women is economically makes a huge difference, even in this country, United States, if you were able to equalize the women's participation in the labor force, it would add 5% onto the American GDP, way above any stimulus package. So I think it's a really fundamental question. I'm afraid that women are disproportionately impacted now, and we do really need a way through the next framework is really to mobilize much greater attention and much greater resources and also make a much better case of why investment in women is such a good investment. Mm-hmm.
And one of the tricky things about kind of conveying these discussions, I guess, outside of development agencies or political circles is that the language can be relatively abstract and kind of utopian, and it's not always easy to make a connection between the conversations in rooms like this and the lives of people on the ground. And so I guess my question for Ambassador Talbot is, can you talk a little bit about the links between actions that were taken around MDG 3s and actions that weren't taken around MDG 3? Because, you know, a lot of things like violence against women were left out of that, and how that's actually trickled down to inform policy, to inform development goals, to affect women in your region.
Thank you for that question. I think what we've noted is a recognition, first of all, that, for example, CEDAW itself did not speak very to the question of violence against women. Of course, it gave a broad brush in terms of all forms of discrimination, but the question of violence became came into the lexicon a little later than that. And there was a separate declaration on violence against women. And what we have seen in our region, in various countries of the region, is a move on the legislative front to address violence against women. In Jamaica, in Trinidad and Tobago, my own country, there have been laws passed and in some cases provisions expanded subsequently through revisions to address the question of violence against women, to criminalize things such as marital rape, for example. These have become parts of features of some of the legislation in the region. And so I think the recognition, the realities of violence, notwithstanding the agreements sometimes catch up with the realities. We find it in another sector of concern for our region, which is the question of non-communicable diseases, which was not covered in the MDGs, but which is seen as a growing concern in the region, affecting also significantly the lives of women. You know, hypertension, these chronic diseases, diabetes, etc. So I think what we find is that the realities are, people are responding to the realities in the societies, and as a result of that, the post-2015 opportunity allows us to bring those realities more into the mainstream of global focus and so address through the global cooperation more effectively, try to address these challenges that might have been missed in previous consensus.
Honorable Montaño, I think there's a consensus on this panel that violence against women should be a big part of any standalone gender goal. But how do we measure it? How do we track it? What are we? What can we reasonably accomplish? So, what do you think this goal should consist of, and what do you think we should be measuring?
Well, before I respond to that question, and I thank you for it, it seems to me very important to speak some more about resources, where they come from, and why resources allotted to these issues should, at times of crisis, be allotted to them. I think that, logically speaking, in a model in which growth is the most important thing above all others, it is only logical that the first thing to be cut back is that which goes to the human being, even in the more sensitive areas. But if we start to think about these goals in terms of a different model, not a model which proposes as success growth, but a model which, for in which success means living well, and all human beings living well, then it is more difficult to be able to eliminate an investment in human issues, in issues relating to the human being. That is why we cannot speak of gender equality. In my view, you cannot think that resources will not be taken away from gender issues if we continue to think of a model whose end goal or main objective is growth, economic growth. In Bolivia, the model of well-being entails a complementarity between men and women. Complementarity does not, therefore, mean the well-being of one of the parties. It means that both contribute to the building of equitable development, harmonious development, and not harmonious only among human beings between men and women, but also between human beings and the environment and Mother Earth.
Does complementarity imply different roles for men and women?
La complementarity includes, or it is inherent in complementarity, that there is difference, that there is diversity. There cannot be complementary between equals, because complementarity entails that diversity is at the service of harmony, and therefore it is inherent in complementarity that there is difference and diversity, differences between men and women, differences between cultures, which are also different, diversity that one finds between different forms of economic development. Bolivia, in its economic model, understands that there are different forms of economic development within our country. There is private economy, there is the state economy, which coexists with other forms of economic development, such as community development. Our indigenous and rural communities have economic models which are specific to them, which are diverse, and which must be complemented. So it is difficult to think of development models where growth is not the only form of achieving success. Only through those models will it be possible to achieve real equality between men and women, in our view.
Ambassador Gunasdottir, can you also address this idea of complementarity, and do you see that as being kind of consonant with a broader framework of equal opportunity, equal rights, equal access to resources, to education, to professional opportunities? This is a very old division within feminism, right? This division between kind of different roles for men and women and making sure that we value them equally, as opposed to breaking down those gender differences. And I'm not sure how that will be reflected in the goals, but the Scandinavian countries in general have taken a pretty different approach to these questions.
Thank you. The principle of complementarity, as I have understood it, is usually that the one that is most capable of taking on a task takes on the task. I mean, that is how I understand it. As I said, I think from where I am coming from, I don't think, I mean, we might not necessarily disagree, but this is not our approach. I mean, because our approach is more based on human rights. I mean, the sort of human rights that we have agreed on at the UN through our different declarations and resolutions and the CETO convention and so on. I'm not so sure we are speaking a different language. I think we are maybe just approaching it a little bit differently. So because, I mean, there are, in my society, we have almost 80% of women are in the workforce. I mean, when we look at gender equality, we are very much looking at ensuring equal opportunities for men and women, and that there is equality when it comes to legislation and economic measures and so on. I mean, that neither men or women should be the end result is always to try to ensure equality, I mean, before the law and in practice. So I don't know if because with violence against women, for example, I mean, that's something that is just totally unacceptable, and it has to be approached from a right-based approach, basically, and encompass all violence against women, and specifically the most prevalent, domestic violence and sexual violence. So how to measure that, that is something we have also discussed very much at my mission, is the main thing is to come up with targets. It's not the, I mean, we can then work on the indicators, but those are not the most important ones. The most important is to agree on the goal and the target and then find ways to do it. And there we can look at best practices, because there are a lot of best practices, I think, within different societies where we can share information and hopefully learn from each other, even though it's not always the same measures that are applicable to different societies.
I have one more question for John Hendra before I open it up to the audience for questions. And that is, when you're talking about women and sustainable development, the question of population and reproductive health and rights always comes up. There wasn't a specific reproductive health and rights target in the MDGs, although it was enfolded into other targets. Where does reproductive health and rights fit into a standalone goal, into the other goals, and how is there a way to create consensus around an issue that tends to be one of the most kind of contentious in international settings?
Thank you very much. Just in terms of the broader context for that, just to agree with the previous... Just in terms of the previous speaker, Ambassador, just that from our perspective, I think, is really looking at the whole post 2015 agenda as being a rights-based one. I think particularly the process of forming the agenda, really focusing on issues of inclusion, ensuring it addresses issues of equality, of non-discrimination, of accountability. So I think, you know, what we're talking about is really both the synergistic element of the goals, but also realization of women's human rights. And I think it's very important to be very clear on that. And I think that's why for our paper, in terms of which I understand the colleagues have as background, we really talked about gender equality, women's rights, and the empowerment of women. Because I think it's really important to really be very clear. It's an intrinsic agenda in terms of addressing and achieving women's human rights, but it's also more of an instrumentalist or a synergistic agenda in terms of what makes effective development. In terms of sexual reproductive health and rights, I think they're absolutely critical. We would see that would be part of a standalone goal. That would be in particularly the issue of ensuring women's expanding women's capabilities and access to and control over resources so that they have the full choice and options over how they live their lives. So sexual reproductive health and rights, we would feel, is very fundamental to that part of a standalone goal. But also we feel that that's also extremely important in terms of ensuring sexual reproductive services, education, youth education, as a very important part of target of a health goal. So we would see it both as part of the standalone goal, but also something that we do need to ensure is in the health goal. I think there's three or four major reports that have been done, as you know, outside the UN, the high level panel, which is an independent panel to the Secretary General, the report by the Global Compact, 500 private companies aligned to the UN Global Compact principles. A report by the Sustainable Development Solutions Network, which is a network of scientists and academics, co-chaired by Jeff Sachs. Also, of course, a lot of reports from the UN, including A Million Voices, whereas the UN Development Group, and I co-chair this work, this task force, has consulted in 88 countries around the post-2015 agenda and has had 11 global thematic consultations. It is important to say that in both the high-level panel report and the SDSN report is a very clear recognition of the importance of sexual reproductive health and rights and how important it is to address that. And in the consultations that have been held around the world in many of your countries, of which you're represent in your country's parliaments, have also identified this as a very, very important issue. It is politically sensitive, however, or it is sensitive. However, it is fundamental to the realization of women's human rights. It's also it's also fundamental to gender equality. So we feel it should be both a part of the overall standalone goal, but also we need to ensure that it is also properly addressed elsewhere, and also comes out of the context of national discussions about what is important in terms of ensuring much greater free access to services. We talked earlier about accessibility, about equality, and this is a very important element in terms of ensuring greater public access.
Okay, so with that, I'm going to turn the questions over to the audience, and just if you have a question, press the microphone button, and I'll call on you by number. We're going to take about 4 questions at a time, address them to the panel, and then move on. So I think we already have one. 1023. 1091.
Yes,
1069 and 1084. Yes. So let's start with 1023.
Bonjour, je suis ici Michel.
I'm Michel André. I'm French. I'm a French senator, and I sit in the coordinating committee for the women of our parliamentary union. And I'd like to say how IPU is aware and has set itself as a goal, gender equality, in the parliament. Because we are members of parliament here. And it seems to me that for most of us, I'm convinced that all of us, is a goal we all want to attain. When there will be more women in Parliament, and when there will be more women in Parliament, they will take into account the problems and all of the women's issues, whether it's contraception, the right to abortion, education, health, violence, all of vocational training, all these issues. And women's issues will be taken into account more. I'm convinced of this. I was the Minister for Women in France a few years ago, and we had a vast plan which consisted in giving better vocational training for better access to responsibility, greater responsibility for our lives as women, and the questions of violence were discussed at length, and the fact that we should be fully fledged. I think what we have to do is deliberate about equal rights so that we have a mix of society in our countries. There may be some people who think it's going slowly, and people can believe that. But I think we're on the right path. Even if France isn't the best student in the IPU class, when I see what the Senegalese and the Algerians have done to achieve parity, when we look at their parliaments today, we see that we are on the right path. And I don't think we should waste time about talking about complementary. Complementary means that sometimes women, in order to enter into the debate, apologize and say they when we were additional, we're complementary. On the contrary, we should sit side by side with the men. You will have less seats because we want our share. And let's be simple. Our men are allies. Sometimes they're not. And they consider that we're demanding. But I think the real equality will be ensured by equal rights for all women and women being in parliament, and the ability we will have to educate girls better. That's a major aim, because you know that uneducated girls are girls who are the first victims, and they're fragile women. It depends on the demography of the world. And I think in IPU, we have the tools in many countries we have to look at CEDAW and all this, and I think we have to have a mix of society and equal rights for men and women. Thank you.
Thank you very much. 1091.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Katri Komi, Member of the Parliament from Finland, hereabout. And I agree very much with the high-level panel that no society has become prosperous without a major contribution from its women. And that same has been very true in the case of Finland. We have been growing in 100 years from poor, very poor rural country into a prosperous country. In many of the world rankings, we are in top positions at the moment. In our first parliament in 1907, we had about 10% of women parliamentarians. Now we are up in 42.5%. Until a couple of weeks ago, we had more women ministers than men. So it has not come easily. It has not come without a lot of legislatory work, gender budgeting, etc. But I'm not saying that we are there yet. We are not there yet, either in Finland. So I think these sustainable development goals, which are going to be binding to all countries, there will be a lot of things which we also would have to do. For example, the problems we are dealing with in Finland are doing with domestic violence, which is a problem, and too slow growth of women in very top positions in economical life and difference in wages, etc. So we also have things to achieve. But researchers have proven that when women can decide how to spend household money, they spend it more in their children, for example. When women have property rights and inheritance rights to the land, the efficiency of agriculture and tools, also food security, is drastically improved. And also when thinking about what I just said, by that also good nutrition in children will be improved. So this all could be a very good circle. So my question to the panelists is, at the end, excuse my voice, I'm having a flu, so I'm almost losing my voice. But my question is to panelists, do you truly believe that we will get strong enough gender and equality goals and targets to sustainable development goals? Because in some thematic fields, like, for example, Security Council Resolution 1325 or Beijing Platform, it seems that we have actually stagnated or maybe even gone a little bit backwards. And at the same time, I think that in some countries where women have achieved a lot already, men are kind of awakening and maybe starting to oppose some of these things where we still try to improve the situation of women. Thank you.
Thank you. 1103.
Shukran.
Thank you. Dalal Zayed, Member of Parliament in Bahrain and Chief of the Legal Committee concerning the gender equality before the law and women empowerment in all fields. We think that this is one of the most important issues, and we work hard to achieve that in our Arab and Gulf communities on the regional level. We have to keep in mind what we have achieved, but we have faced a lot of challenges. But I agree that this should be a standalone goal, because we want to consider women's rights as part of human rights. And in this respect, I would like to say that we are trying in the field of gender equality in a non-traditional framework away from the laws. We want to have our look in our societies, and we want to have the good implementation in reality at the level of the institutions that are concerned with women. Therefore, we started to establish an institution that cares about women, and we want to achieve the needs of women through a special budget for the needs of women. And we have trained the human resources on how to address the needs of women, because this is one of the most difficult challenges, budgeting and finding a way of dealing with these issues. The basis is the training of the parliamentarians on how to address women's special issues, because we always find that the mover for women issues in the parliament are women, and because there are few, there should be support by men in the parliament concerning women issues that need laws. Among the laws, even in our constitution, there is a provision on which we base, namely that the state and the parliament should devise special laws supporting women in particular. Therefore, we started with establishing a committee on women and children in the parliament, and we established a unit for equal opportunity between the two gender, and we wanted to embody this in the sense that it should be a special separate mechanism. And in view of the challenges, we would like to increase the representation of women in decision-making. But we don't only target the number, but we would like to have an effective participation of women in this respect. This is in addition to being keen on giving training for the parliamentarians on issues of women, and we are in need of that. I have emphasized this before, and now I am emphasizing it once again. We have a message and a question. We should study the concept of gender equality in the light of different systems and different religions between countries, and the concept of equality might be different in my region than any other region. There could be certain constraints in this respect that should be respected when we base the principle of equality. We apply it before the law, and now we tried to. Now we have achieved certain advances. In conclusion, I would like to direct a message to the Committee on Women in the United Nations and for the IPU concerning the Committee on Women Affairs. We have missed their interest in Arab parliaments, especially in the Gulf, and in their cooperation with us. The IPU has been absent for us for 4 years. Among the most important issues was the gender equality, but we are not dealing with it now. And now the proportion of the parliamentarians in the Gulf areas has increased. And there is a member in the Shura Council in Saudi Arabia from amongst women. As for the Committee on Women in the United Nations, we have no cooperation between the parliamentarians and this committee in the Gulf area in particular, and some Arab countries. We do not want to reach a point that would be requested. But we are asking you now, away from the policies and away from the guided programs, this is my request. If the objective is international, it should be addressed by all parliaments in the world. Thank you.
So I'm going to take one more question, and then I'm going to turn it over to the panel once again. 1069.
Thank you.
And then we're going to come back.
Okay,
so.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Farooq Naik. I'm a member of the Senate from Pakistan. I must say that IPU is doing a tremendous job with regard to gender as linchpin of development. like several other countries facing similar circumstances, Pakistan has made slow but steady progress.
Sorry to interrupt you for a second.
Yeah,
could you speak a little more directly into the microphone? Or actually, I don't know.
Okay. I was saying that like several other countries facing similar circumstances, Pakistan has made slow but steady progress towards improving gender equality through empowerment of women. Pakistan has been pushed back, as you must be aware of the effect on gender equality, during decades of war and conflict in the neighboring Afghanistan and the militants and the Talibans who have made the life of Pakistanis very miserable and the economy has gone into disarray. The money which should have been spent on the empowerment of women and other social sector is being spent to fight the terrorists and their nefarious designs. But anyhow, the commitment of Pakistani parliamentarians, politicians, and civil society and the media is there to a great extent, a recovery has been made, an improvement has been made in the situation for women. In this regard, I must say that about 23% of the women are members of the parliament in the lower house, which is National Assembly, as well as in the Senate, which is the upper house. And we have passed a law which is known as Protection for Women Against Harassment of Women at the Workplace. And as a consequence whereof, we have established an office of ombudsman where the women can make complaints, and it is being headed by a woman who is a retired judge of the High Court of Pakistan. And similarly, there are centers which have been established in every organization where the women who are sexually harassed by men, they can make complaints, and as a consequence whereof, a lot of improvement is being done with regard to the gender equality. And finally, I must say that you must be aware of the fact that the young girl, Malala, who was shot by the Taliban, has become a symbol of gender equality, has become a symbol for the empowerment of women, has become a symbol for the education of the women in Pakistan, and we hope she's a very brave girl, and I hope there'll be more women like that who would come forward and make Pakistan a state and a country worth knowing. In this regard, I have got two questions to ask. One is, what are the synergies between gender equality and sustainable development? And the second is, how to ensure that gender is mainstreamed through the SDGs? Thank you.
Thank you very much. So it seems like there are a couple of questions that, or a couple of themes that came up in several of your comments. One of them was about the question of representation. Several people have mentioned the number of women in parliament. And should that be part of a standalone goal to be, to encourage greater numbers of women in parliament? The representative from Finland mentioned the stalled progress. There were several years when it seemed as if women's rights were surging forward on the global agenda. There was a lot of excitement around Beijing, around the ICPD, around a whole series of global conferences. Now there might be a sense that things have stalled, and whether you agree with that and whether there's a way to regain that momentum. And then the gentleman from Pakistan asked two very pertinent questions about the synergies between gender equality and sustainable development, and how gender is going to be kind of interwoven throughout the SDGs. And so I'm going to let each of you address any of those questions, one of those questions, starting from the left with Ambassador Greta Gunnarsdottir.
Yes, thank you very much, and thank you very much for the comments. I am going to comment on the last point that you made on if the enthusiasm has sort of evaporated and what we can do about it. I think in my experience here at the UN is that when we are in forums where gender is the main issue, like the Commission on the Status of Women, when we are in the third committee discussing resolutions on gender and so on, I think there is a fair amount of enthusiasm, awareness, and commitment. And there might still be disagreements, but I think the problem, we enter a problem when we go into other fora, when we are discussing other issues that are not directly related to women. Mm-hmm. And there we need more awareness, basically by experts and delegates of member states, and more of a commitment to mainstream gender. And I would just like to mention one example. I mean, we had the arms trade treaty negotiations going on in the summer 2012, and then again in April this year. And at the beginning of these negotiations, there was not much discussion on women and gender-based violence, which is very relevant when it comes to conventional arms. And but there were certain delegations that really kept on mentioning this issue and the importance for including a provision on gender-based violence. And in the end, there were over 100 delegations that signed on to a demarche to include it, and it was included in the end. But I think in the beginning we had disarmament experts around the table, and they were not really gender conscious. And this is something I think is an overall challenge, really, in each of our countries also, that we tend to discuss gender separately, as it is a separate issue. I believe when it comes to the goals, it will help actually to make it a separate issue in a standalone goal, to make sure that everybody knows that you need to incorporate gender. So I will, and there was a question on if we truly believe that we can get a strong goal. I really believe that. So thank you.
Okay, Gabriela Montaño, you've argued that a lot of these, you know, that there should be a standalone goal focusing on violence, but that otherwise it should be, gender should be integrated into the rest of the SDGs. So can you talk about some of the specific ways you see that happening? I mean, how we ensure that gender is a part of every aspect of sustainable development?
I think that in my first statement, you interpreted that there should not be a standalone goal for gender equality. I think there should be a standalone goal, but I firmly believe that it should be mainstreamed in all of the goals, because otherwise we would incur many risks.
A standalone goal, but focused primarily on violence against women. Is that wrong?
I think that wouldn't be sufficient, because it's not the only subject, but namely violence, but I think that it should be made more visible in the goal, in the post-2015 goals, include violence. I think it is important to understand the role of the leaders, both the male and female leaders, in progressing, in having progress in the on gender. Therefore, I think that women's participation in the decision making can accelerate this process of making progress for gender equality. I gave the example of Bolivia, that there were 50% of parliamentarians in the Senate, and this was included in the constitution and in electoral laws, that there should be parity and alternance as a principle of our constitution in our laws. Parity means 50%. We previously experienced quotas of 30%, etc. But the only thing that guaranteed that there were more than 50% of women was that there would be parity and alternance in the that this would be included in the Constitution and in our laws. I think that the laws are very important because they generate stability in change. Change isn't because of the will of a political leader or of a certain president or someone, but rather because the norms make it mandatory for the system to work in that way. And I think this is an important element. Henceforth, I also think that, as certain people have said, who spoke, have said, that it is important to have the respect and support of male leaders for the gender equality agenda. In my countries, we could not have made many progress in our laws if we had not received the support of President Evo Morales, but also male members of parliament. And that is because there was their involvement in the process. These men who represent society were involved because they were elected by society. I don't think that equality and complementarity are opposing concept. I think there was a question with regard to this. I don't think complementarity is the opposite of equality, but rather in societies where there is more diversity, where there's more cultural diversity, there's economic diversity, etc., complementarity helps us to achieve equality goals, because everything isn't seen as being uniform. Society isn't a uniform society, because in reality it isn't uniform. My country is a country which has huge cultural diversity. In my country, you can't only speak about equality, because complementarity gives the possibility that a culture which is different from another can coexist in harmony, and it can, and there can be synergy. And finally, I'd like to answer your question. I think that the efforts which have been made, like certain institutes like UN Women, to have indicators in order to measure gender equality are tools which can help all states to make progress with this in the agenda. The commitment which our states can make in knowing and adopting and using these tools and these indicators is something which is very important in the immediate future. Yesterday, I believe there were 52 indicators which have been established, a huge number to be able to measure gender equality. In other words, gender equality has to be measured in many respects and not just in one. And therefore, equality linked to development, a comprehensive development and the well-being of human beings, what we call living well and well-being, has to have concrete measures which we can have measurements. In Bolivia, we have developed mechanisms to generate better living conditions in the economic area, credit, access to land, etc. And that's perfectly able to be measured. In most regions in my country, 5 years ago, only 10% of women had access to land title. And now they have, it's 50%. That can be measured. And it's a mechanism which allows these women to change their quality of life. So I think it is necessary that states should adopt not only consensus on the goals, but also agreement on indicators which will allow us to measure how we can make progress with these goals.
Thank you so much. Ambassador Talbot, to restate somewhat the question from the gentleman from Pakistan, where in the Sustainable Development Goals should, can you give us some practical examples of where you think kind of gender can be integrated in areas that maybe it hasn't been integrated before, or areas where development has fallen short because the gender piece of it has been ignored?
Thank you. I think in some respects we might be facing a hypothetical in this case because we are yet to define what the goals will be. We have some ideas or proposals from different sources. But I think the basic principle that we support is integration of the goals across the spectrum. There seems to be, for example, some notion of goals in the area of health, and that would seem to be one of the areas where women's issues can definitely be reflected. Building off of the MDG, for example, some aspects which are lagging behind very significantly. Questions relating to education, I think that is also an unfinished agenda from the MDG, and where we can build in targets or goals pertaining specifically to women and or girls. Questions relating to participation in decision-making, I believe, in the event that we touch on questions of governance. And I want to underline, I think it's very important that women are at the table and are part of the decision-making on the future of the agenda. And clearly there's been some progress at the parliamentary level and reflected here, of course, in the audience. But also, I believe that needs to be extended to other levels of governance, at domestically, for example, at the local government level, et cetera, the incentives for women's participation. So those are some areas where I think one can have an accent on women's empowerment within an agenda, which, of course, I emphasize is still in the process of being defined, and we are yet to come to that stage of negotiation on what it will finally look like. But we might have an idea. Thank you.
Okay, so since I asked you an extra question before, I'm going to turn it back over to the audience. And so that we can get more questions in, maybe if you have a question, you can direct it towards a specific member of the panel, and that way we can move on a little bit quicker. So I have 1084, 1014, 1177, and 1092. So the first one is, where did it just go? 1014. I apologize. And I see some people are raising their hands, but just that's not going to work because I'm not going to be able to remember in what order you put your hands up, so just press the button. So 1084.
Yes, I lifted my hand so you see where I am. Yes. My name is Margaret Mensah Williams from Namibia. I want to know, you know, it will not help for us to have country papers here whilst we have the presentations. For us is to come with solutions. My first question to all of us here would be, how many of us have ratified, signed and ratified CEDAW and the optional protocol? That's one. How many of us have, you know, within our budget allocations, look into the MDGs? And it seems to me that, and I want to ask specifically the question, and I don't have a specific panelist, is do we really believe that we can have sustainable development if we have not mainstreamed these issues? Because when you look at issues of violence, violence is not featuring there. And it is just, you know, a problem because we have a lot of violence in the whole world. And violence is what preoccupies women so that they cannot enter the decision-making positions. And if you look at the United Nations, for instance, we send peacekeeping troops, 1325, 1820, all these beautiful policies and resolutions we are making and laws we have. In Namibia, I can boast with many, many laws. I will not go into that. But my issue is, have we ever, or does the panelists think that if we start to at least say that women's inequality and violence against women is an emergency if we can reach somewhere? Because we started with MDGs, beautiful names, beautiful English. Now we come to SDGs. I don't know what we will call it next. But on implementation, it's zero. We have seen when it comes to gender, immediately people's antennas go up that it's women. And once it becomes a women's issue, then funds will not be allocated, number one. Number two, it becomes, you know, a separate issue. It's compartmentalized. It's not part of the mainstream. If you do gender budgeting like we are moving in doing in Namibia, then you will see that sustainable development will come. We have the Beijing Platform for Action. How many have implemented it? It's standing out the 12 critical areas of concern, but those 12 critical areas of concern are ignored. So within all these intricacies and complexities in sustainable development, growth, etc., the main issue here is if we don't empower women who are peace builders and peacekeepers, we are not going to get girls to get educated and boys to get educated. If we don't allow women to also own land, we are not going to go anywhere. If the economy is still in the hands of a few, women will not be in a position to move out of violent relationships. And that, to me, is the crux of the matter. We can go into so many issues that, you know, at the United Nations we send the troops, but how many troops have been sent to protect women and girls who are raped during those situations? But we increase the number of troops to go and stop, you know, the war. But how many, or how much money has the UN actually allocated for women's equality and the human rights of women? And do you think that we should have women's rights? Should it not be automatically enforced within human rights? Those are my basic questions to the panelists.
Thank you so much. And I think that's probably one of the most fundamental questions in all of these panels is how do you take the kind of beautiful language of all of these goals and resolutions and make them a reality on the ground? But before we get to that, 1177.
Okay, thank you. My name is Monica Green. I'm from Sweden. And first I have a comment about this backlash discussion. And in Sweden we also have a backlash right now. We did have 46% of the parliaments who were women 10 years ago. But since the last election we have only 43%. Because we have a new party who don't think that equality between men and women are an important issue. So we also feel that we have a backlash. But I also want to put some other words about this power, because I think that men feel that the power is going away from them, and they don't like that, and they are not going to give it away. So we have to do more so we could force this these issues. And we have more levels there women should have more power. It's of course in local levels, in municipalities and in regional levels, and also in parliaments, in national levels. But also here in IPU, we still haven't had a general secretary or a president who is a woman. And in United Nations, we still haven't have a woman as a general secretary. So we have a lot of levels more to go before we are equal. And in the private sector, we can see that the men still have the power in Wall Street and in a lot of bank sector and in the big companies. The men are those who decide. So we have more to do. I also would like to add this violence against women. It's linked to sexual violence and rape, and it's also linked to prostitution. And when I say prostitution, I mean both trafficking and prostitution, because as long as we have men who think that they could buy another woman, another person, because that person are poor, we have a long way to go before we are equal. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I should have said this before, because we have so many questions, if you could try to keep it to under 2 minutes, and as we start running out of time, I might have to interject to keep it under 2 minutes, because I want to hear, and I'm sure the panel wants to hear from as many people as possible. The next question is from 1092.
Thank you,
Madam Moderator. I have a few comments. I'm Meole Traoré from Burkina Faso, from West Africa. I think that with regard to the topic before us, there are some minimum conditions that need to be met in order to have the progress we desire. The first thing is that it is important to achieve this in all our communities. We hear about it in many speeches, but there's also always a difference between the texts we adopt and the speeches we hear, between that and the reality we see in the field in our communities. Therefore, and I think that the Parliament should do this, we should really think about our real communities. I think that's the first condition to make progress. I don't understand how we adopt so many conventions and the governments enter into commitments through treaties. All of that, of course, is necessary, but that's not essential. What is essential is the action on the ground and the social dynamics which parliaments can create. My second comment has to do with education. All those of us know that whenever we have been able to make progress on women's issues, it has been because there has been an effort made on education, and that is essential. That means that the funds that we devote to national education are essential everywhere. There will be no progress on these issues while women don't go to school enough in so many societies. And both in the North and in the South, this is very important. I'd like to add a key element, and that is the specific role of parliaments. One of the problems that parliaments face when they approach these issues is that they should question in each parliament, what is our vision of women's issues? But most times they don't think of a vision. And without a vision, then, of course, there are many activities. But we must take ownership of these issues in the national parliaments first, and then also, at least in Africa, in the community parliaments. because regional integration is extremely important in Africa right now. But we realize, and we realize that it is one of the main vehicles for success. And in this room, we have the Parliament of the West African Economic Community. We have the Parliament of ECOWAS. So all of these regional parliaments have also got to make strides, as well as the national parliaments and the community parliaments. And they should support women's movements in all countries. I come from Burkina Faso, one of the poorest countries in the world, but it is one of the countries, together with Mali, Niger, Benin, Togo, where progress in rural areas requires the action of women's associations. And parliaments are not sufficiently open to those associations. But progress takes place very often because of those women's associations. These are associations outside of parliament, but we must encourage all of the parliamentarian women to support these associations. And my last comment has to do with the role of men on these issues. Based on experience, I know, and I've said from experience, because I'm a traditional chief. I'm about to finish. Whenever we have made progress, it has been because men have been involved. It's because these are women's issues, but they should not be the only ones to be active. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And the final question from 1008 before we turn it back over to the panel.
Merci beaucoup, Madame.
Thank you, Madam Moderator. I would like to join the previous speaker who spoke about theory and practice. And I think that a male voice in this debate is a major contribution. Can you hear me? Yes? All right. I was saying that the voice of men are clarifying contributions here. In terms of the theory, it is easy. In our country, the Constitution recognizes that we must implement all international provisions, and that is the theory. At that level also, and I'm the first vice president of the Senate in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. We have subscribed to all legal instruments on women's rights. That is the theory. But in practice, what is the situation in practice? First of all, we, for example, in the last elections in the National Assembly, out of 500 deputies, there were 47 women. Out of 108 senators, I will not mention how many were women, because there weren't even five senators. So, as you can see, five out of 108, that means that there are problems to be solved. Now, what are those problems? First of all, when we speak of all of these theories, we must distinguish in our African societies, and I'm speaking of the Africa I know because I live there. The reality there is different. The image and the status of women in our societies is different, and that must be taken into account before we think of all of these generous theories. And to do that, we must improve that situation first. In Africa, we have women. How many women lead political parties? Practically none head political parties. You have 52%, for example, 52% of the electorate are women. But how can you explain 52% are women and only men are elected? It's because, other than the women who are here, women do not vote women in very often. And it all depends on the political will of the women themselves. And we, generous men, will help them and will support them. So I insist on this will on the part of the women themselves to take on that responsibility for their future. This is my contribution.
I think what we're hearing over and over again is a certain amount of frustration about the gap between the kind of beauty of our language and, or the gap between theory and practice, as this gentleman put it. Is what, if anything, can we do, and what is the role of parliamentarians, who obviously have a huge role in kind of shaping the reality on the ground, what can we do to better translate the theories, the ideas, the goals, the commitments that we make in rooms like this into reality for people on the ground? And I guess I'll start with you.
Well, I think that the first comment in this round spoke about emergency in relation to violence. And I think that it would be interesting to discuss with you an experience that we are just starting in Bolivia. Our law, recently we passed a law, a comprehensive law against all forms of violence against women. And in each region of the country where there are levels of violence which are unmanageable or too high for what we want as a society, it is possible for that reason to declare an emergency, just as you declare an emergency when there is a climate problem, when there is a natural disaster. In the same manner, it is possible now in my country to declare an emergency owing to high levels of violence in some regions. That, of course, offers the possibility for special resources to be released to address the problem. And, of course, an emergency situation in the case of violence against women is not something that can go on. There, it is limited in time, and then that emergency situation comes to an end. What is the logic behind this? The same one as applies to any natural disaster. The use of resources immediately on a timely basis and in larger amounts in order to adopt measures that may change the situation rapidly. I mention this because I think that to a certain extent, we should consider, as states, the possibility of creating mechanisms like these so that international cooperation may act opportunely in some regions, in some countries, when those states themselves deem it necessary under their sovereignty to do this. I think that it is something that could apply locally or could apply in a larger sense throughout the entire world. I also think, and I insist again, I think that the participation of male MPs in this discussion, and also male public officials in implementing and operationalizing the policies and programs adopted by states to fight against violence and to bring about equality between men and women, that is fundamental. Not because I think that it would be a concession on the part of the male. I don't think it is a favor that they would be doing us. It is, in fact, a matter of power, and there is a power struggle involved. However, the participation of males who have been made aware of the need to contribute to gender equality as a fundamental pillar of development and of well-being and of living well, that must be taken into account and that must be considered important. I insist again, women's participation. We do not believe, because we have experienced this, cannot be conceived in terms of quotas. Women's participation in decision-making spaces must take place on a parity basis, not only in parliaments, but also in the executive and the judicial branches. And I do not believe in the logic that says that women don't vote for women. In my country, for the first time, we have put to a vote the election of the highest judicial authorities of the country. And the person who received the largest number of votes at that first election was a woman. It was not a man, it was a woman. And that authority has the support and the legitimacy of having received the popular vote and the popular support. So I don't think that one can say so clearly that women do not vote for women. There are many experiences that show the contrary. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, Ambassador Gunnarsdóttir, you have to leave in a few minutes. So before you go, if I can ask you the same question, do you have ideas about how we can narrow the gap between theory and practice when it comes to gender equality?
First of all, I wouldn't like to talk about theories because I think we have commitments. And that is what the parliamentarian from Namibia pointed out very clearly when, with her reference to CETO and to Beijing. So we have the commitments. I mean, when a state becomes a party to the treaty, there is an international legal obligation to implement it. And when it comes to Beijing and all these resolutions that we are adopting here at the UN, we have a political commitment to implement them. So it's not a theory. It's really commitments. And how to translate those commitments, I mean, how to into implementation, actually, I think when I have the audience before me who are all parliamentarians, I mean, you are people with power, and what is the tool of a parliamentarian? It is to produce legislation, and when there is a legislation, it needs to be implemented. So it's for me, it's a fairly I would see it as a fairly simple way of translating obligations into implementation. But of course, then the political will needs to be there, and that seems to be where we are meeting some challenges, unfortunately. But I am very glad that CETO and Beijing were brought up, because we are now in the process of working on post-2015 and the Sustainable Development Goals. But we shouldn't forget about the obligations that we already have on the table, and those are very strong obligations. So it's more how can the goals help with the implementation of commitments that have already been made, or sort of complement what is lacking in those obligations that we have made earlier. And as some have pointed out, there is a deficit when it comes to violence against women, and that is a huge problem, and it's a problem in all of our countries. It's not specific to developing countries or developed countries. It applies to all of us. So that could be highlighted in the Sustainable Development Goals, because it is a problem that needs more attention. And the same goes for political participation. And here at the UN, I mean, there has been mentioning of 1325 and the following resolutions in the Security Council. When we look at the discussion, there is so much more willingness among member states to address women as victims rather than equal participants. And that is something we need to change, because we need to address women as victims, but we also have to make sure that they are equal participants. Otherwise, we will not change things. So that is also why that is something that should be looked at seriously when it comes to sustainable development goal standing alone. So with this, I would like to thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, so we have a half hour left and about 10 more questions. So we're going to take all the questions and then have you hopefully help us sum it all up. And so but we're not taking any more questions if you haven't already pressed the button. So we're going to start with 1014.
Soy Gabriela Cuevas.
I'm Gabriela Cuevas from Mexico. First of all, I think it important that questions of gender should be considered on the basis of human rights and not thinking only of a development strategy or in a more utilitarian strategy, which has happened in some cases. It should follow the logic of human rights. And I think that we can all see this very clearly, and this has been part of our speeches. How to change it, however, depends on two very important issues. One has to do with cultural change. If we do not support not only women in terms of her involvement in politics, the labor market, the economy, but if we don't support women from infancy, then we are not making the necessary cultural changes so that that girl is empowered later on and has information to come forward in cases of violence, to have more opportunities in the labor market or in corporations. I think that a first question would be, how can the cultural changes be brought about? As long as culture does not change, the patterns will continue to be the same. Violence, domestic violence, is based on custom, and a woman who grows up with violence in the family very likely will allow violence against herself. On the other hand, I also think it important to note that women have not done enough for women. We should not only expect men to do something to facilitate women's participation, but we have to do it ourselves. One out of five women parliamentarians in the world are women. We are 21% women parliamentarians. And it is not clear that there are strategies, for example, in terms of budget or legislative or public policy, whereas women, we are trying to take that step forward for a new generation. If that work had not been done before us, many of those of us here today would not be here. So I think that
I have to cut you off there, and I'm going to have to be a little bit obnoxious about timing so that we can get to everyone. So thank you so much for that. But our next questioner is 1038.
Hello, my name is Kawai, Chairman, Standing Committee on Foreign Affairs, House of the Representatives of Japan. Unfortunately, we have seen little in the way of specific results in promoting gender equality and the empowerment of women. But there is one remarkable grassroots example I would like to share with you. About 2 hours by car from the Bangladesh capital of Dhaka lies the rural region of the Nolgindi district, blessed with an abundance of nature. Here in this community, many children and pregnant women with reduced resistance to disease have died due to poor access to medical services. One female researcher at the Japan International Cooperation Agency, whose name is Ms. Yoshimura, has been working in this district since 2006 to provide comprehensive technical cooperation, which includes creating a system whereby local authorities can autonomously coordinate between medical facilities and the needs of the residents and spread basic knowledge about maternal and child health. From a female perspective, Ms. Yoshimura has been able to create a map showing where prominent women live and attend births to help save mothers with cooperation from local residents. In addition, the local religious custom says that in order to remove impurities after giving birth, the mother and baby must live for a while in a separate hut outside the main house. There have been hygienic and disease-related concerns about the way their huts were built. But changing customs is not simple, and so comprehensive was required in order to promote safe birthing and child care. In order to change community awareness, Ms. Yoshimura used her perspective as a woman to create a group to study the health of mothers and children in the village, expanding the problem-solving activities of villagers themselves in conjunction with the local NGOs. As a result of her efforts, there has been a rapid increase in the number of pregnant women using the public hospital and a major decline in deaths, as well as increased knowledge about safe births and the construction of a support system for pregnant women in the local communities.
Hey, thank you so
much. The Bangladesh government has been very impressed with these activities, and it's currently in cooperation with Japan to expand the program to overcome all areas of the country.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
See what I have? Stopwatch. So, our next speaker,
1104.
Thank you, Muhammad Al-Mahdi. I'm from Bahrain, MP. I'd like to speak about men's support on legislation for women in Bahrain. I worked in the Commission for Women and Children, and the president of the commission was a woman. We supported this work from the point of view of legislation, financing, and the implementation of proposals for women. We have two chambers, one an elected chamber and one an appointed one. In the appointed chamber, we have four women. And during the first legislative elections, we did not have any women members of parliament. Now we have 11 women who were nominated in the second chamber. We always opted for gender equality under the laws, and we work to support women, to protect her dignity, not imposing work which is not consistent with her capacity, and we protect her against any person who wishes to traffic persons. We consider women in the same way as society as a whole, because she is the mother of the other half of society. We will have to change laws to ensure that women become the origin of all laws. And I propose that commissions be established for women and children in all parliaments, and that the IPU work for women. I wonder why you did not answer the questions which were raised by my colleague, who asked why CEDAW has not contacted women in the Gulf region to create a system of equality. And I hope you'll be able to answer that question.
1124.
Merci, Madame la.
Thank you, Madam Moderator. In most cases where conferences of this type are held on this subject, the discussion is always spoilt at the end because of affirmative action where the moderator is always a woman. Now, speaking about gender equality, in this room in the United Nations, MDG 3, Goal 3 was adopted in the year 2000. And this was to give access to women to employment and the process of development and basic services as well as decision making. This was an approach which was focused, and it was also cross-cutting. Today, you're adopting a similar approach, and we're evolving towards a different concept. Because last year at Addis Ababa, people wanted to restructure the MDGs to take into account the deficiencies there were in the definitions. Today, people are speaking about the SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals, where we're going towards defining a standalone goal on gender equality. Don't you think, and this is my question, that we're going to fall into the same trap? And given that the very fact of concentrating gender equality and women's empowerment in a single goal and taking two or three goals in a cross-cutting fashion, that means that the goal will have been set aside. Because, for instance, in my country, in Chad, it's only last year that the government adopted a national plan for gender development. In other words, it took 10 years. So the problem of political commitment of states is involved, and also the appropriation of the MDGs, which hasn't concluded. And we're already starting another process with other vocabulary, other definitions, and it's easier in Western countries where the institutions are strong, then it's easier to change. But in our countries where 90% of the women are illiterate, when only one out of five children finish the primary cycle, where the mindset is difficult to change, how can you meet these challenges in third world countries, in our countries?
Thank you so much. 1113.
지구촌의 그 동.
Thank you. Colleagues from around the world, so thank you for this opportunity. My name is Hunsung Lee from Korea. And as a father of two daughters, it's a great honor for me to speak on behalf of gender equality at the UN. Korea currently has a woman president, and we're in the process of full-fledging reaching equality in our legislations and our policies. And the government is spearheading effort to protect mothers and children, and this has been very effective. Women who are considered weak and vulnerable, we have to protect them in order to enhance the society as a whole. Therefore, the government has to play a leadership role. Many countries are talking about equality in terms of wages and protecting mothers' health. There are guidelines and recommendations from international organizations, and these are being legislated at each country level. And if each country can implement this full-fledgedly, I am sure that we will be able to reach gender equality. Therefore, I would like to ask my colleagues work hard to achieve legislation in this aspect, and also if you can monitor how this is implemented in the policies. because women are mothers, our daughters, and our sisters. Many of them face obstacles in joining society. And if we take the view that women are part of our family, then I'm sure we can all reach in a more advanced society. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much for speaking for exactly 2 minutes. The next question is 1134.
Muy bien. Muchísimas gracias.
Thank you very much. I'll try and be very brief. Speaking about this new model for development and especially well-being, we cannot exclude from the discussion the role of women, and in particular referring to the economic apparatus. What is important to make visible is a problem contemporary women have. We've spoken that women have access to universities, to high-level education. However, these indicators do not lead to high responsibility in the public and private level, at government level. And it is precisely because of contemporary women have the dilemma of growing professionally or having a balance in their role as mother within the family. I think it is important that we make this situation clear because it is difficult for the educated women. We have to see how we can help the current women. And I can mention Iceland, which has reached a high level of gender equality through labor legislation, which also includes men in the process of childcare. That on the one hand. On the other hand, I'd like to comment on the problem of violence, which is a very difficult problem for us women, and in particular the crimes which are contemporary slavery, like trafficking, which affect women and children. And I think it is important that in international bodies that there may be made clear statements on trafficking and that it is a crime against mankind. And in our parliaments, we have to classify trafficking with all the weight of the law, declaring also that it is completely unacceptable. Thank you.
1031.
Yes, here. Mrs. Thank you very much. Senorita Coordinadora, soy senadora.
I'm the senator from Brazil.
And me gustaría decirle que.
And I would like to say that this is something we cannot underestimate, the question of violence, as many men and women here have said. Through a non-democratic decision, there have been decisions that have imposed gender parity to guarantee equality between men and women. But I'm not sure that that is the best possible way. In Brazil, women are the majority of voters, and there's only 8% of women in the House and in the Senate, which encompass about 600 people. There is a law which determines that the rosters of candidates have to have a 30% of women, and that cannot really be achieved in practice because women in Brazil are much more interested in state office, in the judicial branch. We have the president of the judiciary, and there are several specialties which women are attracted to. But in politics, it's hard, it's difficult to apply the 30% rule. The representative of Mexico spoke of something very special, which is culture. How can we change culture? How can we ensure that women can enter political life? And to change the culture is very important. And we see this with Malala in Pakistan. Education is essential in the process to change culture and to reduce violence against women. Violence is not a simple matter, is not secondary, as Our colleague from Bolivia said, violence against women is an extremely serious thing. It is an emergency. And Malala is the clearest example of this. We need to change cultures, and education is fundamental. My doubt is, how can we achieve this? And also, because to impose things is not democratic.
Thank you. 1111.
Thank you. My name is Jung Hee Chan from Korea. In Korea, there have been diverse efforts to institutionalize maternity protection, gender equality for employment, and the increase of women's political participation. In reality, however, these efforts are not enough to overcome a gender gap and inequality. It is required to remove all sexual discrimination and develop offensive corrective measures for promoting the investment in women as follows. First, the Public Official Election Act should be revised to realize political representativeness by women. The 50% quota system should be reflected into making a public recommendation for district members in addition to proportional representation. Second, between men and women, equal pay should be assured for equal work. As long as women labor is treated for a low pay, gender equality would not come true. Third, it is required to integrate a gender equality perspective into national policies and projects such as a gender impact assessment. Through a gender-sensitive budget system, we have to pursue a balanced national budget. Such above efforts would be realized when we view women resources as a power for the future growth, and the national leader holds a strong will to develop them. What do you think of the most effective method to reach these goals about women? Thank you.
Thank you so much. We have four more before we're going to sum all this up, or try to sum all this up. 1107.
Yes. Thank you. Shukran. And Ahmed.
Thank you, Ahmed Jarwan, chair of the Arab Parliament. And I'm talking for a while about the Arab Parliament and 1 minute about UAE, the Arab Parliament. And as a chief of it, I have 4 deputies. I have 2 as women from Sudan and Qatar. Women in the Arab world is a partner in the decision making in the political and social fields. And in the Arab Parliament, we have a committee that is concerned with women and children. In the Arab Parliament, we are about to establish a law and a study to protect Arab women in general, and we call upon all who want to participate in this conference to get in touch with the Arab Parliament. In the United Arab Emirates, the deputy of the speaker is a woman, and woman in the UAE is now a partner, even in the armed forces. Woman is a pilot fighter, and she is an ambassador and a minister, cabinet minister, and effective partner in decision-making in the UAE. We are proud of the Arab women, and we are proud of all the women in the world, and I thank the IPU for putting forward this important issue, and I call on the world to have harmony and love between all parties. We are not only men and women, but we all human beings that complement each other. Thank you.
Thank you so much. 1066.
Latifa Diwani, a counselor in the Moroccan parliament. I say that any development, whether for human being in general or for women, is linked to having social stability and constitution that respects the right of women. And in my country, we have seen some developments, but we preserved stability through the adoption of a human right-based constitution. And as for the status of women in Morocco, and because of short of time, I would refer to certain developments in Morocco. There is a big progress, and I will give only a few little hints. Among the most important things is the reform of the family code adopted in 2004 to open the door before real equality through giving all rights to women, and the amendment of the nationality law. And the Moroccan mother now can give her nationality to her children. And in consonance with the human rights law and gender equality, the message by His Majesty the King to the session of the Council of Human Rights in Rabat, concerning the Universal Declaration of Human Rights here, we have declared that we stick to the noble principles in this document, and we referred to the gains through the declaration of His Majesty the King and the withdrawal of all reservations on the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. We also directed a message to the Secretary General saying that we have lifted the reservations of Morocco on this convention. And going back to the new constitution, it gave supremacy to the international law over the national laws in dealing with women against women. And Article 19 adopts equality between men and women concerning all rights on all fields. And Article 22 banned all violations on the physical harm. And to consecrate all of these, the new constitution creates institutions to play an effective role in gender equality. And among these is the body to fight all forms of discrimination, and the Council on Women and Children, and the National Council on Human Rights. In conclusion, I say that stability and peace and democratic constitutions is wanted in addition to the political will to develop the life of man in general and women in particular. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We have two more speakers, and if you see me starting to pick this up, it's because the time is going over. But our next questioner is 1011.
Dodi Alex, Member of Parliament, Indonesian House of Representatives. Since this morning, we heard about the sustainable growth, sustainable development, and this very afternoon, we talk about the mainstreaming gender. I believe that those goals should be more than rhetoric. And then the next question is, what are the strategies in paving toward the path toward the mainstream gender? Indonesia set an example by setting up the law, among others, to oblige the political parties to include at least 30% of women in all potential candidates. And since we are here not only to define the goals, but also how to achieve those goals, so I believe that my next big question is, are there, if any, some effective measurements of mainstream gender exist, or could it be developed throughout the SDGs? Thank you.
Thank you so much. And our final question comes from 1063.
Thank you. It's like you.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much.
Me llamo Gregorio
I'm Gregorio, and I'm from Equatorial Guinea. In principle, I should like to thank this panel and the importance of its content. I'm going to begin with two questions, and then I'll tell you about the experience of my country. Is it possible to have a single model for gender equality in a heterogeneous world with different cultures and traditions? And if that is possible, and that's my second question, who would monitor the applicability or the monitoring of this? Equatorial Guinea has implemented strategies mainly based on the training of women, and that training is mainly based from childhood and with a women's approach, because she's the woman, because she's a protector. And then education is free up to university, because it is understood that when a woman is educated, she's much more advantageous to the country in general and for society in particular. Our colleague from Burkina Faso has said each parliament should have a program for the implementation of the theme of women, both at local level as well as at regional level, and mention the difficulties to determine how they could achieve the goals. Otherwise, there's improvisation. And the programs of each government and parliament, we haven't had time to describe. So women are the cornerstone in our democratic system. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Now, I don't envy you for trying to respond to all of that in a couple of minutes, Mr. Hendra, but I guess there's two themes that really seem to stand out in everyone's, in all of the questions and comments. One of them is, how do you make sure that this is more than words? You know, how do you transfer this kind of high-flown language into real change on the ground, especially given that, you know, we've fallen short of implementation on some of the other hard-won agreements? And then related to that, how do you address the very difficult, deep-rooted issues of culture that can stand in the way of gender equality?
Great. Thank you very much. And I'll try to answer those two, but maybe seven kind of general points in terms of maybe not necessarily summarizing, but what I heard. The first is in terms of the overall objective. And really, I heard very clearly two things, both the realization of women's human rights and a lot of discussion about CEDAW and the importance implementing those rights, but also the development case and the synergistic role that investing in gender equality and women's empowerment, women's rights can have across the framework. Secondly, I think there were the three areas that we've identified as UN Women for a goal were areas I felt really dominated the discussion. Any violence against women, and I'll come back to that. Secondly is ensuring leadership in the public, private sector, families, and communities. A lot of passion about that, but we're still at 21% in parliaments. I would say three African countries that I know that didn't speak, Rwanda at 64%, Senegal at 42%, and Mozambique at 39%, are very important examples. But again, how do you change the culture in terms of moving forward beyond perhaps temporary special measures?
Okay.
And then the third kind of element is expanding women's capabilities and access and control of resources. I think I also, there's a lot of discussion on how best to mainstream, and I think we need to learn from the lessons of the MDGs, where they were very easy to communicate and they galvanized huge attention. However, I think as many people said, they did not address the really root causes of power relations and structural discrimination. And so we need to do it, we need to do mainstream this time by really looking at, and there's some questions about data, is disaggregate the targets and indicators by sex, by income, by area, and really look at how we can ensure that they are mainstreamed across all three dimensions of sustainable development, economic, environmental, and social. But I guess the root question is how to close this gap between theory and practice. And I think we can only close that gap if we actually look at addressing the root causes. And I'll use the example of any violence against women. Any violence against women, 1 in 3, actually 35% women around the world, it's a universal issue, face physical or sexual violence during their lifetimes. That's 35% of women around the world. And it's really important, as many of you have said as parliamentarians, to have a good law in place and a policy framework and really look at the security sector. And there's lots of evidence. The more women that are judges, the more women in the police force, this violence comes down. It's also very important to look at issues around prevention. But we have to address the root causes. And we, as UN Women, have done a research of 10,000 young men in some Southeast Asian and Pacific countries. And the level of violence against women in those countries and rape ranges from 15 to 62%. It's about 45% across the board. And most of those young men have committed rape before the age of 20. And most people posit, well, that's socioeconomic status, or that's poverty, or that's alcohol and drugs. No. Overwhelmingly, it was sexual entitlement. These men felt they were entitled, that they were sexually entitled to commit rape. And it's worsened by the issue of impunity. So we will only really advance in some of these critical issues if we actually address the root causes. And root causes are power relations, how we are socialized in our various societies, and really in changing some of the more traditional and some of the more, and this goes in every country. There's a huge debate in this country about that, and rethinking the issue of masculinity. So I think we really need to be able to close this gap. We need to be very clear that we need to do things different, qualitatively different, but we also really need to address the root causes. And finally, I think that comes to the issue of the role of men and boys, which there's a lot of discussion as well. So men as leaders, men as role models, men not as bystanders. So the men who see incidents of violence, they intervene. But most particularly to look at the issue of power relations and some of these more deep-seated issues of inequality that are more complicated, but they're the root causes. If we're going to change reality, we have to, through this agenda, address the real issues that hold women back and really still contribute to gender inequality.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you to our two remaining panelists, and thanks to everyone. Thanks to all of you. I'm leaving, but you should stay put because there's going to be an announcement from the Secretary General of the Interparliamentary Union.
Well, thank you very much. I just wanted to remind you that you are all very cordially invited to a reception at the IPU headquarters here in New York. And it's within walking distance. So if you take your time, walk not too fast, you will be arriving there just on time. It is literally across the street. It's in a building known as the Uganda House. It is where the Ugandan permanent mission is. It's behind the US mission. It's on the corner of 45th Street and 1st Avenue. It is not raining outside, and it's a lovely reception inside on the 10th floor. You're all very welcome. Thank you very much. And tomorrow morning we start, I believe, at 10 o'clock sharp, and we hope you will all be back. Thank you very much.